Podcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Illini Studio, Champaign, First Federal Savings Bank of Champaign-Urbana, Central Illinois IGA Stores, and Weiskamp Screen Printing, Champaign. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This Saturday, WILL is hosting Home Movie Day, part of a nationwide celebration of home movies as documents of family and community life. Film experts from the University of Illinois Library will assess your 8 or 16 millimeter films and offer guidance on preservation and reformatting. Best of all, we'll screen examples of archival films from Central Illinois history. Bring your films or come just to enjoy the screenings for Home Movie Day at WILL's TV studio in Campbell Hall from 1 to 5 this Saturday here at WILL Urbana.
It's 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, and you're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Jay Pierce. Celeste Quinn's away, but we do have an archived interview coming up now from Celeste. And a reminder that since this is pre-recorded, please, no phone calls today.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. Today we're going to take a tour of a few of the basics of science. Our guide is award-winning New York Times science writer Natalie Angier. Prepare to launch your sense of wonder this afternoon as she may tell us about cells and whistles and show us for whom the bell curves. Those are two of the chapter subtitles of Angier's new book, The Canon, a whirligig tour of the beautiful basics of science. Angier is out to show us a good time as she offers a glimpse into such disciplines as biology, chemistry, and physics. Science, she says, is fun. It's fun, quoting here, the way rich ideas are fun, the way seeing beneath the skin of something is fun. Natalie Angier's honors include a Pulitzer Prize and a Journalism Award from the American Association for the Advancement of Science. She is the author now of 4 books, including Woman, an Intimate Geography, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and was named a Best Book of the Year by several news media. The Canon, a whirligig tour of the beautiful basics of science, is published by Houghton Mifflin. Natalie, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. When did you first fall in love with science?
I fell in love with science as a girl going to the American Museum of Natural History in Manhattan, and continued my love through college when I always knew I wanted to be a writer, but took a lot of science classes and tried to think of how I could combine my two loves, and I did it through science writing.
And you didn't consider a career in science per se?
No, I didn't ever think I would be a good enough scientist, and I also, as I said to somebody, why ruin a beautiful love affair by getting married to it? Which is not to say that scientists feel that way about their work, but I think it does take a certain kind of perhaps patience that I didn't have. And when I worked in a lab for my first book, just in the course of reporting it, and I worked in a lab, and I would do things like spill radioactive labeling all over things, and it just seemed like I didn't quite have the dexterity for it, if nothing else.
Well, you're quite dexterous as a communicator, and we thank you. For doing the work that you do. We already have a listener who would like to talk with you, so rather than launching into another question, let me take this call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Oh, thanks. I was expecting to wait and hear more about our guest, but I appreciate the chance. I'm calling because recently I've run across more than one of what I find very interesting in the process of doing science and explaining science. PBS ran a program on Sir Isaac Newton, and just as an aside almost, when he was describing gravitational attraction and describing it in the language of mathematics, that adequately describe the true motion of planets around the sun. One of the cavils, one of the objections that people at the time had was, you may be describing what's actually happening, but you can't tell us what gravity is.
Hmm.
In a similar way, Darwin originally had the problem of, well, it may happen this way, that species change, but do you have an explanation of the mechanics? How is it actually done? And this process, I think the most recent, global warming aside, is plate tectonics, in which the argument was made that continents fit together and probably had at one time been together. And people were loath to accept it because they say, but how do they move? What is the mechanism and the process by which they would be moving? So I'm calling to find out if you have an example that you like, perhaps one that I haven't heard of or thought of, in which people seem to explain what actually is happening, but absence of mechanism, the explanation isn't accepted, even if it's very elegant and pleasant.
Yes, well,
people want it, you know, just A through Z, the whole story. It's either all or nothing. And I'm just wondering if you have an example of that kind of extremism rather than the reality of science, which is step by step, bit by bit, watch, wait, and when you know enough, then you can figure it out.
Yes, I think that this is true, that one of the things that science is very good at is doing things step by step and taking it sort of one factor at a time. And in the first chapter of the book, I describe that the essence of science is really trying to look at one, you're focusing in on one variable, and you're trying to sort of keep that factor steady and not change that and have things around and see what happens when you keep that stable and then do different operations to it. So you're really looking in at one factor at a time rather than, so for example, if you were looking at, you're trying to understand a chemical reaction, so you want to keep the acid and base, you want to keep the pH exactly the same, you want to keep the temperature the same, you want to keep everything the same, and then change one thing. Maybe change one particular, you know, one enzymatic reaction, you're going to change everything else, keep it stable, and see what happens. And that's the power of science, and that's why it can move forward, because it doesn't try to answer everything at once. At the same time, that's sometimes very unsatisfying to people because they want to have that big picture. They want to know, well, okay, so we can explain the Big Bang up to a point, but why did the Big Bang happen? What was there before? Who set it all in motion? Everybody sort of wants that big picture explanation. The strength of science is in doing the opposite and in some ways in suppressing your desire for the big picture and suppressing your desire for the answer. And another thing that's very critical to understand about science and the power of it is the uncertainty of it, so that you're not actually getting a result, a particular point. You're getting an error bar around the point, and that's what scientists are looking for. So the uncertainty of science and the fact that you're looking at one thing at a time makes it very powerful for understanding our world, but then it also leaves it open to the, well, you're not sort of giving me this kind of answer to everything. But that's one of the reasons why I encourage people to know a little bit about science, because it will allow them to play around with it, which is what I do, too. I mean, in my own mind, I may hear about something, the nature of reality, and it gets my mind thinking. It gets the philosophical side of me thinking. It gets the part of me that wants the big answer. It gets me thinking about it in those terms. I'll give you an example of that. One of the things that you see when you start looking at the basics of physics or chemistry or biology is that things seem to be built up out of reproducible units, things that are the kind of modules of the discipline. In the case of physics, you have atoms, and atoms, as one physicist said to me, what's so great about an atom? It's like this, basically, it's a little packet that is easier to reproduce in the same way that if you want to reproduce a word, it's easier if you have letters, so you can say you know how it's spelled, than to try to reproduce a color, which is this kind of more of a smear. So by having units, and in this case, you know, the elements, the periodic table of 115 or so elements, by having these units to kind of mix and match and play around with, we can do all of these great things. In biology, we have the unit of the cell. Everything's made of cells. So you start seeing these patterns coming up, and for me, what makes it beautiful is not just the facts themselves, but I start to put it together. Well, gee, that everything is sort of a combination of units and then communication among those units, connections between those units, whether they're, you know, bonds between different atoms or whether it's the way cells talk to each other in the body. So you have this kind of both the autonomy and the community of reality. So this is why I encourage people to know more about the nature of reality, because it actually, it opens up the inner philosopher.
Hmm. Does a caller want to follow up?
No, that was a real good run from one fact of human, basic human nature. You really do want to know everything all at once, to an explanation of why science is sometimes unsatisfactory. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Other questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the things you say early in the book is that science needs more cachet. Why doesn't it have it? I mean, when we talk about these things, it's clear that it's really awesome.
Yes, it is. Well, it's interesting because I've been trying to puzzle this out myself since it seems to have a certain intrinsic appeal to me, at least. So you wonder, well, why are so many people, the reaction is, oh, I flunked high school chemistry. You know, there's this massive epidemic of people having flunked high school chemistry. Everybody says that to me, but I don't think it's true. But why they have that kind of reaction to it, and it hasn't always been that way. For example, a number of scientists said that when they were young and the space race was underway and there was a lot more enthusiasm about science during the Kennedy era, and I think that one of the things that's changed is our feelings about the future, because one of the things that went along with this very optimistic era of science was this idea that the future would be better than the past, and science was part of that. And now we don't necessarily believe that. We don't necessarily see things as going in this kind of progressive direction, and so we associate science with, in some ways, degradation. Mm. This is just speculation on my part, but I remember that back in the 60s and into the 70s, there were world's fairs. People loved going to them, and that was very kind of science and engineering-oriented, and everything had this kind of sleek aerodynamic feel to it of thrusting forward into the future fearlessly. And now we don't have that, and so with that has gone, I think, the any kind of glamour that might have been associated with science. The unfortunate part is that, I mean, science itself and basic research has not, you know, has not actually gotten any less optimistic than it ever was, and that's one of the things I appreciate about science. It gives me hope, and why it gives me hope is that people have this kind of method of just going after big questions, and they still do, no matter what else is going on politically in our world, or, you know, whatever else you may think about the degradation of the environment. If you go to the great universities, the people there are so involved in their science, and they love it, and they get together, and it's all this, like, these beehives of activity, and they do have this feeling of progress. And that's a sense I'm trying to get across, not this kind of just a wide-eyed cheerleading, but that mm-hmm. there actually is this grand intellectual progress is happening right now, even as we ourselves are not so enamored of the future.
Mm. Why do you think fewer American students are going into the hard sciences?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think part of the reason is I talked to David Baltimore, who's the retiring president of Caltech and a Nobel laureate, and he said that, in his daughter's, when she was in high school, she went to a fancy prep school and took a lot of great science classes, and they had excellent science program at that school. but very few of her classmates were going to, this was in Cambridge, very few of them were going to go on to MIT. They were going to be going into law or high finance, or that the direction of their career was something much more oriented towards basically wealth. And science has never been a profession that you go into with the hope of striking it rich, although some scientists certainly have in biotechnology, but most of them go into it because they love science, and they're thinking they're not necessarily going to be anything other than solidly middle class. Plus, science is it's a career with a lot of long hours, and it's an amazingly anonymous career.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it has a lot of these kind of sociocultural drawbacks to it. At the same time, those who go into it feel like they are the luckiest people on earth because they're being paid to play all day. And I remember the great Primo Levi, the chemist who was in Auschwitz, he said he felt sorry for people who didn't have a lab to go to, and he, in fact, continued his chemistry long after he had taken up his writing career. So there is a sense in which you were privileged to go into it, but, admittedly, you're probably never going to be famous on any kind of a national or international stage. If you ask most people to name a scientist, they might say Al Gore. You know, that would be the extent of it, but it may be somewhat anonymous in that sense, but I think it's very gratifying profession for those who go into it. And I do hope that we recover some of that enthusiasm among young people, because we do need scientists. And I think that although it's an international enterprise and we have people, foreign students from all over the world coming here, it's also nice if people who live here and who are planning to stay here are also going into it, rather than people who come here and very often go back to wherever they're from.
Yeah. Yesterday I spoke with two advisors to the CBS program Numbers. They're folks that live here in the Champaign-Urbana area. One works for a research firm, the other for the University of Illinois. And I asked them if the producers of the show were concerned that some programs could include too much math and science. And they said something that was very interesting, that the show was tested before audiences, before going on the air, and people said, well, we've seen car chases. The science is really cool.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's interesting that, you know, the CSI phenomenon has also taken off, and a lot of scientists appreciate that show because it has that enthusiasm, and it's like, whoa, I got the answer here, you know, running along with this this data set. Hey, I got the answer here, and they appreciate that. So there has been some, to some degree, there has been, I think, maybe almost coming in from the back door, infiltration. But Leon Letterman, the Nobel laureate, would like to see a whole sort of drama done based on lab scientists. And one of the other things about lab scientists and for all scientists is that they actually have the same kind of interpersonal kinds of dramas going on that you would expect to see with any TV show. So, I mean, you can always mine that material. Scientists are just like the rest of us.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit here now about evolution. One of the things that you write about in the book, this is how you put it, the alpha and omega locks and bagels of the life sciences is evolution. And you talked with one of the people that you talked with for the book, you talked with many, many people, a physicist, not a life scientist here making this comment, Robert Jaffe. He said, you know, evolution is underappreciated and under assault. Let's talk about this. Let's explore this. Why is that the case? Is it because it's called the theory of evolution?
Yes, one of the problems is, of course, that the word theory in just common usage means the same thing that to scientists is the word hypothesis. When you say just a theory, it's just a theory of mine, basically just a hunch, just a kind of a guess, just a hypothesis. And in science, when you talk about a theory, whether it's a theory of evolution or Einstein's theory of relativity, these are all not just anything. I mean, a theory is basically this overarching, synthesizing way of looking at the world so that you have a huge foundation to that theory. All of these observations, all of these discoveries, all of these hypotheses that have been put through testing, pulled together into a theory that is then used to explain many other phenomena and can be used to make predictions about what's going on. So when you're talking about a theory in science, it's so far from being just a hypothesis or a hunch to being something that's so well grounded in many, many different observations that we have to pull it together into a theory. And so it is not, I mean, the theory of evolution explains so much about life that to do without it is impossible. It's impossible. And, you know, Dobzhansky said nothing, he's this great Russian biologist, said nothing makes sense in biology except in the light of evolution. So you can't understand anything without it. It explains so much, and it's so well grounded in so many different, I mean, whether you're talking about the fact that our genes, whenever they look at the genes of us and any other organism, you can see an evolutionary pattern. You can clock it by, you know, say, oh, well, this rate of mutation lies between us and them. You see evolution in action in your own life. I know I do. I mean, if you have kids and they have head lice, if you try to get rid of those head lice and you use those in shampoos you buy and you say, gee, they're not working. Well, yeah. Because the head lice have evolved resistance to that. And it just, it's all around you every single moment. So it's amazing to me that it's been under this chronic assault. But I think it comes down to this false idea somehow that if we, you know, if there is evolution, if we are, you know, related to all of these other species, that somehow we weren't made by the hand of God, or you know, that you can't have these two ideas coexisting. But I talk to many, many biologists who are themselves believers. Ken Miller, who's at Brown University, wonderful guy, very smart biochemist, who is a devout Catholic. And so obviously there are ways to have the two things coexist, and that no religion, to me, makes any sense if it completely flouts reality, if it denies the reality that's all around us. So I think there are ways that you can just keep them separate and admit that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution.
Hmm. Evolution, you write, is neither organized nor far-sighted, and you wouldn't want to put it in charge of planning your company's annual board meeting. Evolution is a tinkerer, an ad hocker, and a jury rigger. Talk about the significance of that.
The fact is that evolution works with what it has, not with what it wants. It's
how like life.
And so a lot of the things that you see, these poor, very sort of poor design elements in our own bodies, for example, well, the difficulty of giving birth for women is the fact that we are, in order to be able to stand upright, we couldn't have a big enough birth canal. And so we had to have, you know, sort of all these compromises that are made between the head size of the baby, the fact that we stand upright, the fact that the baby's going to be born a bit premature compared to, say, a chimpanzee baby. There are all of these kinds of compromises that you see in our own biology that are the result of the fact that things happen sort of sequentially and added on and tinkered with, rather than somebody sitting around and thinking, what's the optimum design for this particular problem? So the fact that that happens is, I think, even another piece of evidence in favor of evolution, that we don't have perfection. We don't have something that necessarily is the best way of doing it. It's the best way that could be done, given what went before. But certainly you wouldn't design it from scratch. We have our voice box very near to our, you know, to our food tube, and so we're always on the verge of choking. And in chimpanzee, where they don't have to have this tongue that's able to manipulate all these sounds, you don't have that problem. They don't choke on pretzels. So I think that there are a lot of compromises that have been made en route to every organism you see today that are good evidence that things did happen over time and through what came before.
Yeah, no need for a chimpanzee to know the Heimlich maneuver, as you point out in the book.
That's right. They don't have to know the Heimlich maneuver. So, yeah, I mean, but everything that you look at, actually, you can start to see, you can see all the flaws, and it's just a result of, and again, though, a testimony to the kind of modular nature of things. Things kind of get put together with what you have, and you sort of piece it together, and you come up with something. Hey, it works pretty well, but it's not by any means ideal.
Yeah. You quote Yogi Berra in this chapter. You want to share that quote with us? If you can, should I?
Yeah, if you have, I don't remember. Oh,
should
all,
I prompt?
I don't want to misquote the great man. So.
I guess I could either share it or I could prompt you. But it's such a wonderful thing. I wanted to let you be the one to share it with us. But if the world were perfect,
it wouldn't be.
Yep.
That's right. it's like
that
the world
is
perfect.
So perfect.
Yes, that is exactly what is going on here. If the world were perfect, if there were no mistakes, if there were no mutations, if there was no change in the copying of DNA from one generation to the other, we would never have gotten beyond that sort of first phase of just kind of being mats on the skin of a rock. And so I think that the fact that there are mistakes, that there are mutations, that there is change, is what allows evolution to occur. And why are there mistakes? I mean, there were even mistakes, I think one could say, in the Big Bang, these little sort of quantum fluctuations in that, you know, that initial burst that allowed there to be actual structure to the universe, allowed there to be stars forming and galaxies forming and then we appearing, so that all of these kind of little flubs in the fabric are what give rise to life ultimately. Life is imperfect, and that's the beauty of it.
Mm. Natalie Angier, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's an award-winning science writer with the New York Times. She's the author now of four books, the latest, The Canon, a whirligig tour of the beautiful basics of science. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments for our guest, Natalie Angier. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455 is the toll-free number, 800-222-WILL. I believe at the end of the chapter on evolution, you say something to the effect of, you know, crack open a cell and take a look inside, and it's better than any look at life that you'll get by looking at yourself in the mirror. And there we are launched into the next chapter, which the subtitle is Cells and Whistles. Talk with us about the beauty of the cell, the greatest invention, you say, in the history of life on this planet.
Yeah, the cell is actually one of these, is sort of, in each discipline, I try to get to the kind of the heart of it, the organizing principle that makes everything else kind of comprehensible. And since we have this whole debate going on now over stem cells, and you realize that perhaps people don't have a sense of what a cell is or why we're built of cells. So what the cell is you know, it's this kind of, it's like a little, in the case of multicellular organisms like ourselves, it's if you have this giant corporation, you have these kind of little teams that are actually doing this work, and they have a certain amount of autonomy. And that's what allows you to get anything done. If everything were just done on this giant scale, nothing would get done. So the cell is this way of getting things done, and it is also, as I put it, it's like this little kind of climate-controlled limousine going through this wild storm. You have a cell, it borders itself off, and it keeps its kind of internal recesses controlled to a certain extent. It controls the environment within its own borders at an optimum level for all these important chemical reactions to occur. So it kind of creates within itself this unnatural state of steadiness in the midst of a very fluctuating environment. And so the ability to wall yourself off from the environment and keep things pretty stable inside of you is what gives the cell this tremendous power and allows it to continue no matter what is going on outside. And that's why, ever since the first cells arose close to 4 billion years ago, there hasn't been a cell-free moment on this planet ever since. And all life that has arisen has been as a result of the splitting of cells, of one cell into another and then into a next. That's how new life is created, is through splitting of cells. And it's this idea of keeping yourself under predictable, controlled conditions, no matter what's going on around you, that allows life to continue. So this fundamental unit of the cell is the building block of all of biology. And when I asked, you know, I always like when writing about these things to think, well, okay, you can't see cells, they're invisible. If you had one and you blew it up to the size of a desktop accessory, what would it look like? And so I asked biologists that, and my favorite answer was one from a scientist at Johns Hopkins, and she said, well, it would look like snot. And the idea of, yeah, it sounds kind of gross, but it's this gooey, you know, it's squishy. And in fact, a definition of life is that which evolves, that which reproduces, that which is squishy. And that there is this this squishy quality, so that it's this unit, and it's autonomous, but it's also very flexible. It's squishy, it's gooey, it would look like snot. And so I think that that's another quality of life, is that it has a border and it has autonomy, but it also has this tremendous squishy flexibility, and it's down to the very level of the cell that we see that. Mm. So the fact that we do have this kind of bounciness to us is at every level inherent to life.
Yeah. Well, you know, an unfertilized chicken egg, as you point out, is a single cell. And this is something that you don't give a second thought to, you know, at the grocery store.
Yes, each one is a cell.
I'm going to pick up a dozen cells today in the dairy department or, you know, wherever the eggs are. And it's also really interesting because when you think of the egg white, it's really snotty-like.
That's right. That's exactly right. Now, of course, the true cellular part of that chicken egg is the actual, it's the yolk.
The yolk.
The little sort of boundary around it, and it actually has, you can see around that yolk that it does have that membrane, which is a key characteristic of the cell, and the white is kind of extracellular matrix, but it's still, even the yolk itself, that's pretty, you know, it's pretty squishy too. So yes, there's a lot of it at every level. But yes, that has the fundamental ingredients of the cell. So, except then, of course, when you get a chicken egg at the grocery store, it's usually it doesn't necessarily have anything that's capable of splitting into another cell. So it's...
No.
You hope.
What a cool package that is, though, the egg.
Yes.
That reminds me, you know, speaking of something that's funny, you know, in the introduction to the book, you know, here we're talking about snot on the radio. You note that, you know, kids come to a point where they leave behind that delight in things gross, and they develop a dread of grossness.
That's right, yes. And in fact, if you go to science museums, and I talk about that at the beginning, that science museums are considered for kids, and they, of course, sound like they're full of kids, and the registers of them is very kind of high. And then one of the more popular exhibits at science museums is something called grossology, which is a kind of an examination of body fluids and all this hilarious stuff that you'd think this does appeal to kids and not to adults. So I kind of take that as asking why it is this funny contradiction that people have, that on the one hand, science is for kids, and on the other hand, science is hard. And so we have these very mixed emotions about it. But I do encourage people to go to science museums, even if they don't have kids. I've been to science museums all over, including in other countries, and I often watch the adults who don't have kids, and they always look a little bit embarrassed. They're walking along, it's like, oh, I don't have a kid with me, maybe I shouldn't be here. But they're actually enjoying it, too, when they're allowing themselves. They're really kind of into just the exploration of the state of knowledge. And I encourage people to go back to science museums and to, if they go with their kids, to really, you know, look at everything closely, discuss it with your kid, try to understand what's going on, that there is this process of discovery that once you do it, it's just irresistible. And even going out into your backyard and looking at things in detail, I know that when I force myself, because you know, we walk around with our heads just kind of full of all this daily garbage, if you force yourself to go out and get out of your head and look at the budding of something and try to really see it day by day, or another scientist recommends going out, I'm really just looking at the moon, seeing where it rises every day over a period of a couple of weeks, and you start to realize that there really is an out there, and it's a very liberating feeling because the moon is always there, you know, and you go out and there it is, and you can see it, you can watch it go through its phases, and there's something about that that's a very powerful reminder of the reality of our world. That I encourage people to engage in that as much as they can.
That's the best part of taking out the garbage.
That's right.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Howdy.
Hi.
I want to take exception with something you said about science not being as glamorous as it used to be.
I'm glad to hear that. I thought science was
totally glamorous when I grew up, and I watched the change from tubes to transistors and transistors to chips, and I just think it's fantastic. And as an example, just last week, I got an email on my fantastic machine, of course, that said, oh, they're having this special down at Staples where you can go buy a little RAM stick, a little USB RAM chip, you know, the kind you stick into the side of your computer, for $30. That would hold 10,000 electronic books. So for $100, tax and gas and parking included, I got three of these little guys that hold enough data that I could literally wear an entire library around my neck. 30,000 books is as much as is in the average public library in this country. And this cost me less than $100. And, of course, you can download, you can choose those 30,000 books out of a couple of million books that are free on the Internet. So I think the glamour is right there staring us in the face. I think that the Internet and the computer revolution and being able to compare, to carry these computers in your pockets and read these e-books and musics and videos and everything on your iPods, I think that's plenty glamorous.
Yes, I agree that there certainly has been exciting developments in technology. Whether or not that gets people interested in, I mean, science and technology have always had this bit of a I can't say love-hate relationship, but there certainly is a bit of a sparring between what scientists consider pure research versus applied research, and that question goes on. I do think that one of the things that tends to happen with advances in technology is less and less of a need to kind of understand basic science. And, in fact, one of the scientists said that to me, that that's been a great success story in science, is that people have been removed from the need to understand a lot about science, so that if you don't have to know in the same way people used to know the cycles of the seasons, or to be able to identify any of the stars in the sky, or to know anything about how plants grow, or, you know, that the successes of science is to remove us from the need to have a basic working knowledge of it ourselves. And in a similar way, the more technology is advanced, the less people, I mean, that's the whole idea, isn't it, to remove from people the need to understand much about the details of programming or anything behind the user interface. This is not always a bad thing by any means, but it does bring into question whether or not we we really sort of understand how a car works anymore or anything like that.
I'm not.
You are.
Oh, I am. Okay. Well, I think that that goes back all the way to the first lever, the club, where you whack somebody over the head. You didn't have to understand as much about how to hit them. And it goes to the all the way from there to the automatic transmission of the car, where in my day, people were thought to be idiots if they couldn't drive a stick and didn't know how to use a clutch. It's all a big pyramid that we exist on top of.
Yeah.
And the higher you get on the pyramid, what's that famously weird saying that if it's sufficiently advanced science, it looks like magic?
That's right, yeah.
So it all becomes magic at a certain point where nobody even knows how a match works.
That's right. Well, this is true. And so then the question is, of course, there is the question of whether anybody needs to know it. And this is the whole issue, is what do you need to know? What do you want to know? Sometimes when you learn about something that you didn't need to know about, it's just, wow, that's really fascinating, and I'm glad I learned it. So there is that kind of basic pleasure and understanding that you get. However, one of the things that scientists did say to me that they're very sorry that people don't have a good sense of are things like probability and the likelihood of things happening, what it means for things to be random. There are some basic principles that when we remain ignorant of them, perhaps it leads us into trouble. It makes us do stupid things with our money. It makes us not recognize the meaning of a medical test result and to get hysterical about things we shouldn't.
Well, I apologize. I don't want to fuzzy up the distinction between science and technology. That wasn't my goal. I think that they fit hand in glove very nicely with each other. And as far as the probability goes, I think they teach great statistics here at the university. Myself, I took 4 classes in statistics.
Oh, good. Yeah. No, I know a lot of places teach it well. I think the question is whether kids get it, and whether enough of the general populace gets it. So that's really the issue. Anyway, I do appreciate your comments, and I agree that there's a lot of great stuff out there. So
thanks for the call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That gets us to, you know, here we've got one more topic maybe we can talk about before we have to stop our merry-go-round tour of science this afternoon, and that is the chapter Probabilities for Whom the Bell Curves. And you begin with tossing some coins around with Deborah Nolan. What's she trying to get across to her students with all that coin tossing?
Yeah, it's a very interesting exercise. She has her first-year statistics students come in, and she divides the class in two, and she has one half of the class tossing coins, 100 flips, and writing down their answers, what they got, heads and tails, and the other half of the class imagining that they were tossing a coin 100 times and writing down what they think their results would be. And she leaves the room, and they do this, and then they put their results up on her desk, and she goes through the papers when she comes back, and she says, this is real, this is, you know, made up, this is real, this is made up. She can tell the difference between the real tosses and the imagined tosses. And they're always amazed, like, oh, what did you do? Are you spying on us? And it turns out that real randomness it has a much more of a pattern to it than faked randomness. I mean, you start to see patterns in clumping, lots and lots of clumping. So you might get whole bunches of heads or tails in a row, and when she looks at the faked ones, there's a lot more flipping back and forth. People start to get nervous. They might put like 3 heads in a row and then, oh, I better flip it again because otherwise it's going to look like a pattern and I don't want that. So she can always tell the real randomness because it doesn't look random. And so the fundamental point here is that clumping happens and that if you start to impute meaning to it, you can get yourself into trouble. You can misread reality if you start to say, aha, here's this pattern, when actually there isn't necessarily a pattern at all. So I think that's a very telling kind of exercise, and I myself went through it, and I did these flips, 100 sets of 100 many times, and, you know, I got with like 9 heads in a row, and bunches and bunches of these kinds of things, and I would never have known until doing the exercise just how much this comes up. So I think it's useful to realize that randomness has this pattern, this look of a pattern, and it's actually hard to fake it. So, and of course, mathematicians also know how hard it is to generate true random numbers. That there's all sorts of problems involved with that. But it does sort of make reality a lot clearer to you. Another example of this came up when you look at paintings of the night sky. You can always tell when the painter has actually gone out and looked at the night sky versus imagining it, because the ones that have imagined the night sky, it's much more of a kind of a steady distribution of stars. You know, it's like all over the sky instead of that clumping pattern that you have in the real night sky. So there are many examples of this where if you're trying to fake it, you better be careful. It's hard to do.
You're going to get caught. Natalie, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Natalie Angier, her latest book, The Canon, A Whirligig Tour of the Beautiful Basics of Science. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin.
Good afternoon. This is Dave Dickey. You've been listening to an archived interview with Celeste Quinn, host of the Afternoon Magazine. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's how it shook out on report day. Taking a look in Kansas to begin, the September wheat contract had a high on the day of 664, a low of 650. It settled at 654 and a half, down 5 3/4. December, I don't have the highs or lows there, but I do have a settlement of 669, down 4 1/4. At the Chicago Board of Trade, September wheat, a high of 680 and a half, a low of 661 and a half, settling 667, down 6 1/2. December, a high of 698, a low of 680, settling 684 and a half, down 6 1/2. March, a high of 690, a low of 672, settling 678, down 5 1/2. May, a high of 656 and a half, a low of 643 and a quarter, settling 649, down 2. July, a high of 575, a low of 558, settling 569, up 5 on the day. September corn, in fact, all the corn contracts clawing their way back from negative territory to finish positive on the day. The September version, a high on the day of 337, a low of 324 and 3/4, settling 333, up 3/4. December, a high of 353 and 3/4, a low of 341 and a quarter, settling 350 and a half, up 1 3/4. March, a high of 369, a low of 356 and a half, settling 365 and 3/4, up 1 1/4. May, a high of